Did you know that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day? But don't take my word for it. Actually, you should take my word for it. And here's what you need to do. You need to go to ZipRecruiter.com/Zach. That's www.ZipRecruiter.com/Zach to learn more there about recruiting the best people for your business. The fastest, best people fast. You know that fast, good, cheap pyramid? Well, this is doing it all. This is fast, good, and yeah, you got to check out the pricing online. That's kind of above my pay grade, but ZipRecruiter, check it out. Too many ads. Here we go.
The Zach Kuhn Show.
Episode 69, and we've got John Marks on the podcast, kind of like the gatekeeper's gatekeeper, if you know what I mean. I actually have no idea what that means. I just made that up. But I think that is a cool term. And John Marks is the guy that is respected by all. If you're a gatekeeper, you probably respect John Marks. And if you're in the industry, John Marks, he might be one of the most recognized names in the Nashville music industry. One of them. Calm down. If you're one of those others, you know, I see you as well. But John is up there high on that list. You know, we've actually been trying to get John on this podcast for a while now, and we've never been able to line the schedules up. And I think this is a really exciting time to talk with John, because if we know something about John, it is that he is not afraid of a rebirth. Look at how he built an amazing career in terrestrial radio, and then he moved over to SiriusXM, turned that into a powerhouse, did the same thing over at Spotify, and now he's going on a new endeavor, which we get into and talk a little bit about. And we talk about his brand new website, which just launched. If you want to keep up with the music that John is listening to, there is a brilliant playlist that is on this website, a Spotify playlist, and it's big. It's got a lot of music on it. I was actually going through it today because he just sent it to me, and I was really getting into the head of John Marks. I want to know what John's listening to. And this new website, johnmarks.me, has it all. It's got everything. I don't think this needs much more of an introduction. We all know about John. We all know what he's done. This is going to give you a little bit of a deeper dive, a look behind the curtain is what we get here with this episode. Here we go. Episode 69, John Marks. Let's dive in. You know, I was thinking about you recently because I was talking with a couple of people who I know knew you as you were coming on. I was like, okay, John Marks is coming on. I don't think we've ever met before, but I think we have, except for the other night. We met the other night very briefly at the Basement East, but I don't think we've met beyond that.
That's right.
So I was talking to a lot of people, and I think the funny thing is, John, do you realize how much your name gets brought up, like, behind your back? Like, everybody brings your name up all the time. Do you know this? Do you realize this?
I don't have, I have to confess, I don't have an entire realization of it, but I will say that when it came, you know, when it kind of came to me and hit me in the face was the I emailed John Marks t-shirts that Whiskey Jam produced, and I had no idea I was anywhere worth merchandising. They probably lost a ton of dough on it.
No, but there's also a little bit of a joke. There's kind of a joke, I think, that like people would say, like, oh, what's the plan for your new release? What are you doing? And people would say, oh, we're just going to email John Marks, or we're just going to call it. That was like this was like a thing. It was almost an excuse for not doing any work a little bit, right? Which wasn't
the
case.
I wouldn't call that... True on that. I wouldn't call that an entire release plan, but I'll call it at least the beginnings of one.
the beginnings of a release plan. I'm curious because, you know, if you look back at like some of these, like some of the early promo days, like I always love the story of these promo men like Casablanca who would sit out in toilets where they knew the radio programmers would be, and they would play music in the stall next to them to try to get them to hear the record. What were some crazy things that people did at Spotify to get the record in front of you? You have to have some crazy stories here, right?
You know, I got to tell you, it's not, you know, people didn't really go to extravagant. We'll say, you know, not so much as Spotify, because everything was more electronic and a little bit more formal in terms
sure,
of
yeah, yeah.
How we made arrangements to meet. But SiriusXM, I will say that I did receive a fair amount of stalking there, because whether I'm not sure if you know how to get in and out of the office there, but you had to go into the Visitors Bureau souvenir store. And then there was a little elevator, a private elevator that would take you up into that cone that's at Bridgestone. That's where the offices are. And so you'd have an elevator to get you into that cone. And so people would, watch me kind of come in and out. And I would get stalked from time to time as I came in and out of the elevator, going up and down, in or out of the building. So, and I'll call it gentle stalking. It wasn't there. Nobody was threatening me or anything. But, you know, I will say that that was a fairly, I'll say, a semi-regular occurrence when I lived and worked there.
Would they just like wait outside and try to get you their CD or whatever? Like, what would they try to do?
Yes. I mean, that was really, I said, they would wait however long. Hell, I didn't even know what time I was leaving or coming or going. It was like, so I can't imagine what, how long they stood around waiting. I appreciate their, the one thing that I would appreciate about it, even though, you know, of course they didn't have an appointment, was at least the fact that they were persistent and they stuck with it and they hung around. And even with that, even though I won't call it an annoyance. It was kind of like, I'm trying to get from point A to point B. But I do appreciate their willingness to stick through it. You know, it's, and I had to at least give it that kind of credence. You know, if they were going to be waiting around that long, I at least figured I owed them a few minutes of my time and to take their CD and give it a listen.
Why? Because,
but it was funny.
Because I think people really know you as someone like, you will take probably more so than other tastemakers and curators, unsolicited music, which I feel like is the first thing that everyone says, we don't take unsolicited music. Don't even bother sending it, because it's not going to get through. But you really would accept kind of, or you would take a CD from someone who was stalking you outside the SiriusXM office. Did you find great music that way? Why did you take that approach, or why do that?
For that very reason. I mean, I'll take the analogy of panning for gold. You know, it's like, you just don't know where the next one, next nugget's going to come from. And to close yourself off of any possible lane of discovery, you know, for me, you know, and everybody has their ways or their needs or whatever, their routines. I just couldn't resist the next thing, and known or unknown was really, wherever you came from, I don't care if you landed from Mars. If you have a good song, throw it at me, man. That's kind of where I am with it. It's and so I was really agnostic about who I met with and where they come from or came from. I just wanted to hear their music, and if it wasn't in the lane, try and give them a few thoughts on how they could, you know, get closer in. You know, it's and you know, at least try to help somebody benefit from a little coaching. And so I just really, that's kind of the true heart and soul of what I love doing in the music business. And, you know, even Luke Bryan started somewhere, you know, and all these artists had to start, you know, scratching from whatever they were doing. And I work as best I can to empathize with these struggling starting artists and what they're trying to do with massive odds just automatically stacked against them. And I try to at least do a modicum of what I can to reduce or increase the odds of them succeeding minimally anyway. So I just like, and that's really the overriding reason why I really enjoy talking to those individuals, because it's the most fun to watch them sprout and grow.
Do you think more tastemakers and curators and gatekeepers should take unsolicited material? Because this is the number one thing that they're always like, we don't take unsolicited material. Are they missing out? Are they potentially missing out on great things that you found otherwise?
You know, I think yes. I think because, you know, you just never know where the next one's going to come from, either from outside an unsolicited area, or many times I'd sweep through Spotify's pitch tool in the back end and just find really cool and interesting music that was not brought to me from or us in from the usual credible sources and circles. And Cameron Marlowe is an example of that, the song Giving You Up. I was just going through the pitch tool, just listening to music back to back to back and doing my computer routine. And next thing you know, I heard that song kick in and I said, what is this? Heard it and I said, heck yeah. And literally that week it found its way onto a playlist and that was that. And that's not the only time those things have happened. With Cameron, it came to, you know, him getting signed to Sony ultimately and management and all that other stuff. But I didn't know him from Adam, didn't know his team, if he had a team. Turns out after the fact, I learned it was him from, I think, South Carolina, if I'm incorrect on his point of origin, I apologize. And, you know, people found their way to him through being playlisted. And I accidentally met him as he and I were coming and going in a meeting. That's how we came to meet each other well after the fact of that song coming out. It was an accidental thing. And we've been friends ever since. And so I just never discount any source material at all for those reasons, because you just never know where it's going to come from. More often than not, maybe, maybe not. That maybe does is the thing I'm always looking for and never quit.
Absolutely. You know, I think like one of the most common fiercely debated topics in the Spotify pitch tool is, what do you write in that little paragraph when you have to sell your song and you get like, I think like 600 words, how important was that section? Is that section? And what would you look for? What do you think artists should really try to get across in that section?
You know, who you are, what you're about, a little bit of points of origin, just talk about your music and what fuels your soul and heart. You know, it's, you know, and I think that's really it. I really didn't take, I will say, I didn't take a lot of credence in it. I'm not saying it's not important, you know, but it really was truly, it's about the song. And if you got a good song, the rest comes together. And that's kind of, so where somebody comes from or how long they've been in Nashville and all that stuff is really cool and anecdotal. But I want to hear about, you know, what you love about music and what you love about creating and writing. Those are the things I'm interested in. You know, if you're from wherever, it's fine. You know, it's like wherever you're from, it's cool. But I like knowing about what you are and what makes, what fuels you for music.
And what is, I don't know how much of this is like secret Spotify sauce, but I'm curious. So you go into this pitch tool, you listen to, can't even imagine how many songs. And then right away, a lot. And then right away, do you flag them and you go, okay, this could be good for New Boots. Maybe this goes over to Indigo. This sucks. Pass. Let's send this to Wild Country. Like, is that how you're organizing? And then do you go through everything again and shave it down each week from there? How does the process work?
I can't speak for anyone. All I can speak is how I approached it in my former Spotify life. Others may do it entirely differently, but I would use the pitch tool. I was fervently against it when it first came out. I was not for it at all. But as time went on and it showed itself to be a viable piece of discovery equipment for me and people like me, I came around to it. So I need to establish that caveat. I valued my relationships with music creators in Nashville of all stripes, sizes, and types, and from publishers to producers, whoever was agents, whoever is making music or creating music or in the business of artists and music. And I trusted them as reliable sources and direct contact with artists themselves, and really thought that to be close to sacrosanct in that time. But also, you know, what the back end of Spotify did was expand that exponentially to the best and probably not the best, because now you went from a more clustered universe of music to this wide and deep universe that was a bit daunting to try to get through. But nonetheless, get through it to try. And And what I would do is while I was just doing my computer stuff, I just let it roll through and skip the obvious ones that weren't, meant to be and kind of give the other ones a trial, just depending. And things like, and where I was looking at, it's kind of like a wall of sound, there things are generally the same. And how many times have we all heard that same song redone 35, 40, 50, 100 times? And all that wallpaper just kind of let it roll through. And then you hear something like, Cameron Marlowe giving you up or something sonically unique, different, catches the ears, not whacked out of the universe, but still different enough to be. And those are the things that I would kind of flag and qualify as potentials. And that was kind of the base. And then, we would get pitches from the labels and the distributors, right, and all those things. And, those would be the part of that whole process too. And so all that traffic coming in and what traffic do you take out to compensate for it? It was always an exercise in Jenga each week, and try how to mix and match the jigsaw puzzle, or however you want to call it. It was a fun challenge because I was always emotionally invested in every single song I'd put in. There was a reason for that I had personally, professionally, or whatever, because I like these artists, want to see them do well, but. The problem is it's not to be, not everybody's going to swing and hit it. So you have to make those sad determinations and let people know, sorry, not this week. But that was more or less the process in a nutshell. It was a little bit longer than that in terms of wading through all the music, but that's how it worked in general.
For an independent art, or let's say an unknown artist that you had never heard of, how important was album artwork? If you had never heard of an artist, but you thought, oh my God, this is a great album cover, I'm going to at least listen to this. Would that get you to listen to music? Or if it was really bad, would you just...
If it was really bad or really uniquely interesting, I'd have to give both a little look, just because it's like if you're looking at an accident on the highway, what do? You slow down and take a look, If you got something unique and interesting, you slow down and take a look. So I think that's if it's the same old, I'd say, yeah, okay, seen that, done that. If you're posing next to a pickup truck, wow, where'd that come from? It's like there are a bunch of them. So I think it's to me, it's still really truly within the song. But sometimes, if the title doesn't intrigue you and you don't know the artist and you see something, oh, okay, it's another reason to stop by. I wouldn't call it an overriding primary, but I will say that if it caught my attention, which was rare, but it does happen, that would occur, yes.
Okay, so the album artwork is worth something. Put some time into it.
It is worth something.
Let's go back and for a minute, because I'm trying to understand how you got into radio, and I'm trying to follow this path. And so you were very young, and I've heard the first song that you really fell in love with was "Pretty Woman," right? By
wow,
Roy Orbison. You heard this at a jukebox, right?
Yes. You are good on your research, brother. I congratulate you on that.
You hear this song, you go, "I want to work in music," right? But you couldn't play guitar. You couldn't play anything.
I was just a kid. I was at the Y, on the weekend, shooting basketball, swimming in the pool, doing kids stuff on the weekends. And in the gym, there was the jukebox, and the drum beat starts coming in, the guitar, and Roy Orbison's voice starts. And I said, "Holy shit! That is music, and I love it, and I want to be a part of it somewhere down the road." It's like that was just had such a massive impact on me, just in terms of wow, what is this and where did it come from, and I love it, and to this day I am never sick of that song. And yes, that just had a real impact. I wasn't even a teenager yet. I was just really young, and that just imprinted with me forever. And then along the way, and then listening to my local radio station and growing up with the crazy DJs that were there, WSAI in Cincinnati, it just inspired me with it was so freewheeling, and top 40 back in the day was experimental. You'd hear Frank Sinatra, the Beatles, and everything in between. It was such an experimental time musically with what truly was top 40. And the music at the time was just really cool and emerging. And it just really imprinted with me early on. And I've never looked back at wanting to do something in music from that minute. That's absolutely correct.
But what was that first job that you got? I think at 16, was it WPFB? Was this your local station that had... It had some kind of program, like this entrepreneur program, but I don't quite understand what this is. But what happened? Or what did you get into?
Wow. Brother, you are good. And congratulations on your research. It was my sophomore or junior year in high school. It was able to drive, which was very helpful. It was a program called Junior Achievement. And Junior Achievement did an assembly, and Junior Achievement was designed to encourage entrepreneurship, business learning skills for kids that were in high school looking to go to college or into business, whatever they wanted to
do. Who ran it, or where did it come from?
It was a national organization. I don't even know if it still exists. I'd be curious to know, actually. But it was a national organization. They had local chapters, and you know, everything from the steel mill to, local businesses, and the local radio station had a chapter of Junior Achievement. And I said, well, count me in. And so I was lucky enough to get involved in the Junior Achievement, the radio station local chapter, and me and I don't know, probably I think it was about 10 other kids of my age were in this radio company. We called it the Radioactives, and we were charged with this, with adult supervision from the radio station personnel, of course. It was a small market radio station. We volunteered. We produced an hour-long interview program on a weekly basis. We had to book the talent. We had to sell the advertising. We had to create the scripts, create the promos, do all of that stuff under the direction of Bob Cordray and Rusty Reed back in the days. I'll never forget them ever. So for 2 years, we did that. My first year, I was salesperson of the year. I got me a little badge. I probably still have it in a box today, and a little certificate. And after that wound down, I was fortunate enough to get hired by WPFB as an employee, which was like, oh my God, that was like a kid in a candy store, and it was one of those small market radio stations where you did radio, you did the obituaries, they had bluegrass in the morning, top 40 at night, gospel and preachers on Sunday. It was a beautiful experience because I was able to do a little bit of everything during that time and learn a lot of little things that still hold me in good stead today.
And then how did you start climbing the ranks? Because your first half of your career was in radio. So then you went to college, I'm assuming. And then would you jumped all over the country to, you were in San Diego. How you just kept climbing the ranks basically?
Yeah, I worked at ended up at WPFB for it was probably my last year of high school. Went to community college in my hometown, so another couple of years, and I wasn't full time, but I might as well have been. I spent my summers there. I was old enough to where they'd leave me alone unsupervised, which was probably not the most advised thing I would have done, but they did. And I just worked my summers, weekends, holidays, just soaking it all in. And then I went away to school at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio in 1974, and began working in the Ohio University system, studied broadcasting and business, worked at the Ohio University properties and worked for weekend party money in Parkersburg, West Virginia, right up the road in several locations, and did that for probably close to 3 years. I graduated, got my bachelor of science And then went partway to my master's degree because I love the school cocoon, but decided to kind of jettison that when I started seeing friends and colleagues of mine start getting good jobs in commercial radio. So I thought I better get out and start getting busy and get out of the cocoon.
And did anyone ever say to you when you're coming up, you're studying broadcasting, does your family ever say, okay, this radio thing's cool, but when are you going to get a real job? Or were people supportive of it?
I think my parents probably tried to talk me out of it in any number of ways, but they saw there was none of that going to happen. And I think they resigned themselves to that probability. And if I came home, they would welcome me with open arms. But I think to the very day that they passed from this earth, I don't think they really had a capacity and an understanding of exactly what I did to earn a living. And it was like, I'd take them into the radio stations. I'd take them and they'd say, okay, so still, how do you make a money doing this, and how are you making your rent? I was really never happier than when I didn't have to ever ask for mom and dad for money to have my rent or whatever I needed to do. And I think they were continually mystified almost to the end about why that was. And I took a little kind of perverse joy in that, in a weird way. Yeah.
That's so you were in radio for how long? Like three?
Gosh, you just measure me from 16 years old, if you want to count that as a piece of it, up to 2010 when I left San Diego to join Sirius XM.
Right. So when you left...
A long time.
When you left terrestrial radio, you said you felt that it was losing its mission to serve its local community. What does that mean? What did that mean at the time?
Well, you just look where it is today, and it itself answers the question. All you got to do is just look at it from a peripheral level. The consolidation, and I was lucky enough to be one or two steps ahead of the law, sometimes half a step behind, and I'd get the boot and get back in. But really and truly, yeah, in the Clear Channel days, I was there in where it was live and local. And got out just ahead of all the voice tracking and consolidation and all of that. And, I went to KSON in my final job when they were still owned by Jefferson Pilot, then Lincoln Financial. And at the end of my run there, it was going to be inevitable. This is going down too, not because it was sad, but just really, you got to face reality and where the business and the industry was headed. And I just knew it wasn't much longer for this. And so intentionally, I was getting out of radio. I said, that's kind of the end of the road. And my wife and I were literally packing boxes to go back to Utah, her hometown. She had a house there. So we were going to go just hang out for a little bit, see what's next, and a chance encounter with and I love her to this very minute, to this day, for running into her, Jessica Wade. I don't even know if she's still there at Sirius XM, but she and I met and got along famously. And she said, hey, there's this job you may want to talk to somebody about at Sirius XM. And I said, oh, okay. And I was consigned to getting out of broadcast radio, but then she was telling me, and I hadn't really familiarized myself with satellite entirely, but she said, yeah, there's 15 channels of country music of every different kind and style. And I just got sick of working this one narrow lane of music. I could do it in my sleep. It was Groundhog Day and I was bored silly of it. And so I just couldn't really see another way back or out or in or whatever. And that
Pandora's box.
And now, I said, whoa, there may be another way in here, because it's not just this one thing. It's a whole bunch of different things that I haven't been able, muscles I haven't been able to exercise, including Southern gospel and bluegrass and Christian music and all these other areas where I had, I'll say, a working background, not intimate knowledge, in addition to country music, old and new, and side shoot, tangential subgenres and all the rest. And so that had a high degree of appeal. And I went through the process, made the contacts, and you know, we were still packing because we were still leaving and going somewhere. And instead of Utah, it ended up being Nashville in 2010. And haven't looked back from it since. And it's Providence intervened in a very grand way. And I thank Jessica for tipping me off.
Do you think, because there are programmers all over the country that in theory could have taken that job, which was probably the sexiest programming job at the time, do you think that you just had, they sensed this passion and this, you know, this great, you know, desire to do right by the artists and to give everyone a shot? And did they sense that in you? Why do you think they gave you the shot to do this?
I think and I don't know for sure. All I can do is extrapolate. And knowing some of the people they were talked to in it, I think I was able to exhibit a wider and deeper background in the form, not just today's country music, but you know, I had worked with Southern Gospel, I had worked with Christian, I had worked with bluegrass, and I dealt with it even in tangential ways, and I think that helped edge me into the job. And the thing of it is it really, it was not sexy. It was not good looking at the time. You got to remember nobody wanted to be part of it. You know, Nashville hated SiriusXM, quite frankly. I wasn't greeted with hostility. SiriusXM was. At the time, you know, they had just merged with Sirius and XM. Their stock was below a dollar. They were in danger of getting delisted. And they were in a lot of trouble. And kind of how I approach it is, hell, we were going to Utah anyway, you know, and if something happens, we'll just go back. No big deal. And it was a low risk, high reward opportunity that, hey, whatever. It's like we were going to Utah and we can always go back. It's not a big thing. And it's worth a try, you know, because if this is cool and interesting and still involved in music, I want to give it the go. And it turned around, the business prospects turned around. It just turned into that's when it turned into the gig of a lifetime, as they say. You know, it's like after all that turned around, it was a couple of years to get that done, but it turned into that for sure.
This is kind of, it's sort of become your bread and butter of like, go to SiriusXM, nobody wants SiriusXM, and then you turn it into this natural, you know, thing. You did the same thing at Spotify, where nobody was into, you know, country was not into Spotify, and you sort of now it's like so obvious. But is that something that you had to deal with? Because you came in as an outsider. Nashville, maybe in a cliche way, doesn't like outsiders. They like to hang with the little boys club or whatever. You know, they like to hang with Nashvillians. You came as a total outsider, yeah, with a product that nobody wanted. And how are you? How'd you win everyone over? Because now you're John Marks, but who were you at the time?
Well, I think that, you know, and I will say I was a bit of an outsider, a local radio guy coming in to tell Nashville what to do, you know, and but that was never articulated to me directly. But I'm sure there was some of that was, you know, some, I'll call it healthy skepticism, you know, it's like, and there's nothing wrong with that. I just think that I came in and say, hey, look, you know, and I wasn't greeted with hostility in any way, but they were not shy about telling me how they felt about SiriusXM. And so they weren't aiming it at me. They were aiming it at it. And I said, well, maybe, you know, we can find ways to turn that around. And I think some of that resulted in probably a lack of representation or whatever that was in the beginning, of which I wasn't entirely aware of. And some of it with the merger and all the other things that swirled around all that. So I was just saying, all I want to do is help you and help the artists and help move music forward. And hopefully we can find ways to do that. And that's more or less how I approached that. I wasn't saying, hey, let's do this, let's do that. Let's just mend fences and let's see what we can do to work together, and approached it in a step-by-step fashion. Nothing in Nashville breeds desire more than getting lucky and having a success or two. And the next thing you know, here we go. And so you kind of, over time, you just kind of build it and you know, repair relationships and get that going, and, you know, get people understanding that, you know, if we're going to do something and we tell you we're going to do it, you do it. Just simple things like that. Not to say that SiriusXM was ever dishonest in the past. All I'm saying is, like, here are the things that we'll do, and here we'll make it happen. And slowly but surely built the credibility back.
Do you think something that I'm very curious about is, for example, like one of the first artists that you broke on SiriusXM, Florida Georgia Line, and you were having meetings with them, and they were, if I'm not mistaken, completely unsigned. And because everyone was maybe writing off SiriusXM, did that leave a window for Florida Georgia Line's team to come in and pitch their music for you? And my question is, if you're a developing artist, do you want to kind of find these rising platforms and these rising things and build relationships with them because they're going to be able to take a shot on you? I think you did the same thing with Austin Burke very early on and completely blew him up with his streaming at Spotify. Were those moments able to happen because it was new technology, it was a new platform, the rest of the industry was not really looking at it, and a young artist could come in and capitalize on it?
Well, I think that the one thing among many at SiriusXM helped me delineate, you know, the differences that could be created in a musical impact in a local scenario where your world is San Diego, your world is Salt Lake City, and the world is the United States and Canada at SiriusXM, and the difference a song could make in impacting in a larger scale was just massively different. And you know, Florida Georgia Line, although no one can disagree that that was the, you know, grand slam from hell for everyone involved. But, you know, it's like, it started as like just experimenting, you know, with, and I give all the kudos to the people in New York, Steve Blatter, who said, look, you got to widen your scope, take some chances on music, and get out of the FM mentality. And I said, okay, done. And that's all I needed. In the very first thing I tried, her name is CJ LaRose, and her song was called The Porch. I'm sure it's on Spotify somewhere. And we did a thing where she did some blogging at CMA Music Fest, and we were able to do some video and audio things with that song. And we were able to track that we got new subscribers. We were able to track the sales on her song. And that kind of started helping me, you know, open my eyes, turn the light switch on about what can be done to affect the outcome of a song if you properly apply it in the airplay and you do other things around it. The other one was Dancing Shoes by Green River Ordinance. A friend of mine turned me on to that song. We were
Texas Act,
and Matt Jenkins working with Smack Songs as a publisher right now. Dancing Shoes, I had no idea at the time. It was a three-year-old song. I listened to it from my friend and said, hey, this is a country song. I think this could be something. Played it, Hits One picked it up, turned it into some a pop thing, and it turned out to be a really strong song. I can't remember the figures on it at the time. That was the first real-world example of, hey, you know, you get a song that reacts and really responds, something cool is going to happen. FGL Cruise, but it was not because, I don't think it was because of a new technology or a new thing. I think that I was just on the hunt for new music and new artists and different things that could respond in some way. I'd be lying if I told you that me or anyone else in the room identified Cruise as a record-breaking, genre-altering song that it would be. That was not the case. I think it was between that and Get Your Shine On. We just collectively decided, hey, you know, because Cruise starts off right from the get-go, I think that's probably a better way to start. And then maybe we'll follow up with Shine On. And sure. And we were all good. And next thing you know, there it went.
Do you take credit for what I guess people would call the bro country sound, because that was really one of the first bro country hits. It might not have happened if you didn't. I think you could take a little credit here for really changing the genre in a big way.
Well, I think I'll take some of the blame for sure. It's like, and that's fine. But I think that, and I've said this before, and it's really true. I mean, it's like, I did not do it. You know, Florida Georgia Line did it. The audience did it. You know, I was a vehicle for exposure that permitted it where others would not. And for that, I'll say yes. You know, for the audience reaction, I couldn't engineer that. You know, for Florida Georgia Lines being in position for success, because, you know, they were prepared, they were ready, and they were able to capitalize and build on that, where if somebody else may have been in position, they may have missed it entirely. So, you know, they deserve all the credit for being primed and ready. The audience reacted appropriately. It was a moment in time where the audience and the music was needing to change. And if you think back in the time, it was very sleepy, adult, contemporary, medium, down tempo. And that was a cold dump of Gatorade right over the top of your head. And the rest kind of changed. And so I think I'll take a little responsibility for that being the vehicle or introducing the virus. I don't know. Well, okay, then maybe so. But so I'll take it.
The right elements came together.
By total, I'll say accident and fortuitous timing. Absolutely right.
I want to be sure we have time to talk about a couple other things, but while we're on the subject, I mean, you're kind of bringing this up that it was a little sleepier, I guess is the word you use. And then we had this bro country movement. Then we kind of had this boyfriend country movement, big 90s country movement.
Yes.
Kind of interesting to think about where we are right now. What do you think is the next sound going to be? Can you tell, or do you think we're ready for a cosmic change again?
I think it's already here. I think you look at Breland and Keith Urban, and that's it. I think that, and I've been a fan of that for some time. I mean, even in some elements of bro country, and there are some earlier developing artists in there whose name I can't recall, who are kind of dabbling in that, who are kind of dabbling in bro country and a little bit of hip hop, because that was kind of FGL's beginning modus operandi, right? Really. They kind of introduced it with a couple of songs. And I think it's finally kind of reached a point of about time. And you look at in all of that, you know, I've supported it along the way, even though it was kind of wacky and way left of center, and probably knew it wasn't going to research. But you know, there are lots of points of intersection between hip hop and country that people just don't realize and understand. And I think that it's beginning to be self-realized, and I think for all of its betterment. And I think that you look at that Willie Jones and Breland and other ones. There's Rashad who's coming up, and there are so many of those elements right now that I think infuse in a natural way. It challenges the sonics, which I think country music always requires. And I think that's really, to me, is where the next phase is. And I think, you know, in the pop area, I think it's kind of more, it's less pop, big production and big, you know, sounds. It's more contemplative and sincere. I won't call it serious, but more sincere and heartfelt. And if you can find that both in country and the pop country areas, I think that's kind of where that needs to be right now. And it kind of continues to fuse and confuse in what is and isn't pop or country these days. And I love that. I love those areas of gray.
Love that. Okay. So wait, so now you get pulled into Spotify. We're jumping ahead, and everyone who gets hired at Spotify goes to Sweden for like a week or 2 weeks. Right. And you do this, and I'm assuming like you meet Daniel Ek. What happens on this trip? Is this like sworn secrecy ritual, like robes and cloaks and things? Like what happens when you go over to Sweden, and what do you learn about the company? Like, does the ethos of the company get explained to you, and the mission, and like, what's the takeaway from this trip?
If I talk too freely, my chip hasn't totally deactivated yet. I'm just kidding. I'm teasing. It's like back in the time that I joined Spotify, the onboarding, there was minimal onboarding. And so basically I got my laptop and said, you know, good luck and we're all counting on you. And that was about the beginning and end of it. I did go to Sweden twice, and both it was for parties. So it was and we got some functioning done as well as a group. I went there to Stockholm for their 10th anniversary outing. It was a party, but it was serious too. It wasn't all a drunken festival, but it's like, but it was in celebratory of what they were doing as an organization. And yeah, as a new one too. And it was a small enough culture where you could really bond, where today it's a little tougher because everything is so disparate and COVID didn't help matters, but it's not entirely COVID related. You just have this massive worldwide structure that's really difficult to, I would imagine, keep together and run. I don't envy whoever needs to keep track of all that stuff. But it was instructional. We would have seminars. We would have, here's what this department does and here's what that department does. Because a lot of things, while it strives to be a flat organization, there were still some silos that you had to kind of get through and over and around to be able to get things done. So it was more or less instructions of here's who this is and here's who you need to talk to. And in order to get projects done, you had to stitch these things together because organizationally, there wasn't an automatic flow to how where you'd go for this and where you go for that. SiriusXM had an order for that. And so there was some elements of comfort, even though you could complain about the inefficiencies of it. You know, but there was great inefficiency there because if you had a project in mind, you had to get buy-in. And I think it's still somewhat the case today where you have to get buy-in from these disparate departments to bring these coalitions and these tribes together to be able to see a project through. It's nothing wrong with that. It's just kind of how they get things done and test the viability of a product or the willingness of the individuals to follow through.
Right. How come, you know, I'm curious how sometimes you see these artists on streaming platforms, and this isn't always the case, but sometimes you see these artists who get like 100 million streams or whatever it is. And you, on paper, you look at their streaming profiles, they seem massive, but they might have a hard time selling tickets on the road, or maybe they can't even sign a label deal. Was this something that you would see? Why does this happen? And as an artist, if you're getting these streams, let's say you're having a hard time selling tickets or getting that label deal, how do you think, what advice would you give to artists to sort of power through that or try to make everything come together?
Well, I think that, and even in my days at Spotify, I would say, and this is the truth, you know, it's like every day I'm talking my way out of a job, you know, and it was somewhat prophetic, and, you know, but real. And I think that the obsession with playlisting and artists is about the same obsession as it is with getting on a radio station and getting on the charts. And I would, you know, work as I could to counsel them that it's a straight peak up and it's a straight peak down. And it's just like with anything that you have to do as an artist, and the tactics are changing and evolving today, and it's ever evolving and changing. But the first and foremost thing that you need to do is build your foundational elements of who you are as an artist. Who are you as an artist? Where are your social medias? Where are all of those things in relationship to your music? How are you supporting that with friends, fans, and cohorts to build a feedback loop when it comes to your music? That's even before you start releasing a song. And then, okay, maybe you release a song and you build a release strategy on all of that. And I think that, you know, playlisting is like radio. It's kind of a byproduct of all of that stuff. Now, when people would say you get all these streams, and I would say, look, you know, it's like, you know, labels look at it, producers look at it, and if they would look at a Spotify for Artists page, and you would see 2% from the artist profile, 3% from algorithms, 85% editorial support. They just look at it and say, oh, John Marks likes that song. That's cool. And it wouldn't get further acknowledged, not because my word isn't good. It's just simply, you know, that's a good start, but what kind of other support is the artist or the song garnering from that exposure? And if it's nothing, then, you know, it just shows that the song isn't reacting in the other sectors, or the artist isn't supporting it in an effective way to generate that reaction.
Absolutely. Okay, we are running out of time. I have so many questions here. You know, the number one question in Google when you type in John Marks is, why did John Marks leave Spotify? I don't know what we can talk about here. This is the number one thing that comes up when you say John Marks. Look, this is a very personal thing. I don't know what we can say, but I'm going to throw it out there because I think everybody wants to know.
First and foremost, we are still friends. If you hear the lawnmower in the background, I apologize. The thing is like Spotify was in the process, and it wasn't a surprise to me, in changing their curation strategy. Their curation strategy, I saw it happening across the genres. And, you know, I was not surprised to see when some of those elemental changes were coming to the country music space. We had an adult discussion about it, was offered an opportunity to continue on with that. And we spoke as adults and were able to part as friends. And I think that's, you know, and that is a unicorn in today's world. And I am forever thankful for that. And I was just at a function last week with, you know, we all got out. I don't know if that's a Spotify, you know, thing is like, but we all saw each other in 3D and we hadn't seen each other since COVID. And so it was a good reunion. We had a great time. We're all friends. Everything is good. And so I'm, you know, all is well there. And the whys were that they are changing their methodology. The methodology wasn't something that I was really tuned in with. And I think that, you know, the opportunity that I've been provided by exiting Spotify, you know, has opened up a whole lot of thoughts, opportunities, and things that I would not have been able to explore had I continued with Spotify. All the conflict of interest things and things that intrigued me on the outside are now I'm able to discuss freely with, and that's an opportunity that I'll appreciate Spotify for allowing me to experience, and I'll be friends with them, and I'm sure we'll be collaborating on hopefully some projects down the road along with other streaming services, because now I'll be one of those who gets to be sweet and be impartial and hopefully help artists navigate all of those different platforms in addition to Spotify.
And I saw this moment the last week when you ran to someone. I saw this person's face light up to see you at Spotify. And then I was talking with a friend of mine at Spotify yesterday. I said, by the way, I'm going to be talking to John tomorrow, which I asked him. And he said, oh, we love John. Everybody loves John Marks over at Spotify. I think they might miss you over there. I don't know. But okay, this is true. The second thing that pops up on Google when you type in John Marks, the second response is, what is John Marks doing next? Everybody's typing this into Google. Everybody wants to know. Let me ask you this. What areas in audio excite you right now? Or where do you think there's great opportunity? Or what's the next big thing do you think going to be in the audio world?
Well, Zach, I'm glad you asked that question. you know, I've explored a lot of different things. What fuels my heart is working with music creators, large and small, different in all capacities. I don't care what genre. I don't care what color. I don't care if you're from Mars or Pluto or wherever. I just love working with hardworking people who want to make something of themselves doing music, and I want to join those hardworking people in finding ways to get that done. Simple as that. And it goes with artists who are still viable, who maybe aren't viable in FM radio today. Like, let's call them legacy artists. I don't like that word because that, you know, but I think you look at it, legacy artists who aren't a part of the radio landscape anymore, are minimally a part of the streaming landscape, but maybe we can find ways to translate audiences and build their streaming numbers, bring their audience in. And you know, they're still making music, they're still touring, they're still doing current things, and why not, you know, find ways to help them find a way into that, especially as you're looking at an interest in 90s country and catalog music continue to be strong. So all of those things are fueling my interest. I want to be continuing on the cutting edge of music. I want to be, it's like where I was like, I'll say Spotify permitted the ground floor. I'd like to find a way to get down to the basement floor and start really even, you know, in the more beginning stages and find that kind of element. So those are my thoughts and dreams. And that's what I'd like to see have happen. I've been laying some preparatory work on all of that. And filing paperwork, doing all the legal crap and the tax crap and all that stuff. And then I'm getting ready to, and I will say for shameless plug, you know, I've got a website that will be getting active, I think, as of this recording in the next day or two. I'll pass it along to you. And it's just johnmarks.me, johnmarks.me. It will include some of those fundamentals that I've already described and a Spotify playlist of what I'm kind of hearing in country that's catching my attention, you know. And
is this going to be kind of like a blog space, or what can we expect from this website?
I'm going to not much. I'll have the at this stage, I'm just being honest. It's like it's that and basically a splash page of you know, I'm basically, I hate the word consulting, but I'll use it just as an explanatory thing. And it may grow into all some of these other things. Right now, just to keep it simple, splash page. I want to let it be known that I'm looking to do some business in some of these independent and contracting areas of those things that I've described. There will be an email outreach info at johnmarks.me. You know, that'll be directly to me and I'll answer it personally. And I want to get into that kind of enterprise with artists, and we'll see where it carries me. I've never been an entrepreneur in my life. It's the most exhilarating and scary thing I've ever done. I've had lots of encouragement from friends, colleagues, and allies, that kind of pushes me forward, even though I'm saying, no, I don't think so. I don't think I'm up for it. But, you know, it's something I want to try. It's an adventure, just kind of like having worked into Spotify and worked into SiriusXM. And I'm looking forward to, you know, not just giving it a try. That sounds too casual, but diving into it. And learning the ups and downs and figuring some of that stuff out along the way as I go.
This is very exciting. I'm also curious, are you interested in the video game space at all? Do you and Steve Schnur ever talk about curating playlists and things like that?
I think, you know, we'll sidebar on that. And I am, that is one of the things that I don't know that I know is critically important. I was never involved in that in Spotify because, it was never a high degree of interest in country music. But I think now might be the time. And gratuitously, I'd appreciate an intro.
Absolutely. John, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for making this happen. And I think everybody has their eye on you, because if there's something that you've proven, you've been able to reinvent yourself. You turn SiriusXM into a thing, you turn Spotify into a thing. And I think eyes are on you and everybody's very excited to see what you do next. I know it's going to be big things. So stay tuned. Stay tuned, and audience.
And thank you for that credit. It isn't all me, but thank you for saying so. And I appreciate your kind thoughts and words. And if artists want to look at somebody on how to contemplate an artist situation without the playlisting, please look at David Morris. You know, he's an example, a textbook example of how to do it with minimal editorial support. I want to leave artists and creators with that just as a point of research. And thank you, Zach. It was a pleasure to spend the time with you, and thank you for your interest. And I appreciate that very much. And thank you for letting me be here.
Have we left anything out in our final moments? Have we left anything out here?
I think we've covered most of it. I wanted to bring him in because of the playlisting and lack of it and how do you do it. And you know, that's that'll be a large part of what I discuss in futures. But I think that, yes, it's that I think that's really the primary element. Just think about how you're going to do it without playlisting, and let playlisting be a part of that build as it gets to you.
Fantastic. John, I want to thank you again, and I will talk to you soon.
There you have it, episode 69 with John Marks. First of all, you have to check out this new website, johnmarks.me. For the playlist alone, you need to go to the website and check out John Marks' playlist. There's over 300 songs on this playlist of some of John's favorite picks. And I'm serious, I was going through this today and just loving what he's putting on this playlist, and a lot of stuff that you probably have heard, a lot of stuff that you probably haven't, and you're going to be glad that you check this out. The other thing, you know, my other big takeaway was, don't be afraid to take unsolicited material. I think we often don't take unsolicited material in the industry, and John Marks is the guy who says, well, hold up a second, because if you're panning for gold, you know, you never know where you're going to find that next thing. So unsolicited material, don't be afraid to take it. I mean, that was a great episode. How great was that, having John Marks on the podcast? And by the way, I'm very excited to see what John Marks does next, because I think it's going to be big. And I would not bet against John Marks. That's my tip of the day. Don't bet against John Marks. Here we go. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nashvillebriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. The Zach Kuhn Show is part of the American Songwriter Podcast Network, and we are proud to be part of it. And look, thank you for tuning in. Thanks for being here. We're going to see you next week. Bye.